Hello, would you please state your name, the date, the time, and your location?
My name is Aaron Waters. The date is October 20th of 2022. The time is 6:19 p.m. So I spent most of my time with the pandemic in Portland, Oregon, USA.
And do you consent to having this interview recorded, digitally uploaded, and publicly released under a Creative Commons license, attribution, non-commercial share alike?
I do.
Thank you so much for being here. Would you just start by introducing yourself to anyone who might find themselves listening? What would you want them to know about you and the place you're speaking from?
Sure. So I'm Erin, she/her pronouns. I'm a Black transgender woman. I'm almost 40, so I've made it past the statistics of us only making it to about 35 or so. I'm gainfully employed. Still have access to family and partners, so kind of breaking a bunch of the assumptions and the narrative that is written for Black transgender women at this period of time in our history. I spent many years working in community health. So I started off my healthcare career working in a free clinic that did a lot of work with folks who were active users, undocumented seniors, folks on Medicaid, Medicare, and then a lot of the transgender non-conforming community as well. From there, I started working for large-scale healthcare. And so I worked for some larger corporate kind of nonprofits, helping build their understanding of how to provide transgender and gender-affirming healthcare, as well as doing some work around general like diversity and inclusion type of stuff. And then now I currently work for a small organization supporting, specifically supporting Black trans and queer identities in the greater Portland area.
Would you tell me a story about your life during the pandemic?
So the pandemic really threw me for a loop. The job I was working was definitely one in which I was expected to be in a building for most of my time. I had was doing less of the direct community health work because I had a job code for that and was then coded to be working in our human resources department, specifically around equity and inclusion work because of the platforms that I was able to build, the training that I was able to offer. And I remember being at a conference, a meaningful care conference held near the airport in Portland, and we were all checking our phones all day. When was our company going to tell us to go home? That something was happening. There was an illness that was raging across the world. We needed to go home and protect ourselves. And so we were all just, and throughout the day, different people with different companies had different notifications at different times. So by the end, we were some of the last ones around 4 o'clock. And so I immediately went into not panic mode, but damage control mode. Because my community already struggles with accessing healthcare. While we've made some really great strides in the last 5 to 7 years, particularly on the West Coast of the United States and in the state of Oregon in particular, it doesn't change the fact that there are a small number of providers. Our surgeries can take us out for months and months at a time. And we were already struggling to get access to these things with a bunch of other cis people trying to access care. So I immediately started making phone calls. Who had surgery that was lined up? How can we get them redirected? Are they going to have to cancel? Trying to get information out to let folks know that this does not mean you won't access healthcare. Who can we switch from in-person appointments to telehealth? And how are we going to continue to provide education and training around DEI concepts? How are we going to continue to educate people? And while just switching to Zoom seems like an easy answer, it definitely wasn't. So I was sitting at the Nexus. I was a puzzle piece of so many immediate conversations around how we could protect one of our most vulnerable populations, and at the same time continue to move forward, knowing that if there's a pandemic and it's hitting this country, the people who are going to deal with the most, the least benefits, the people who are going to have the worst healthcare outcomes are going to be minorities, marginalized folks who were already struggling to begin with. And so we were trying to figure out how we were going to mitigate that, because I can't take off my hat of being a Black person and just focus on the trans thing, just like I can't do the reverse. And so how are we going to blend this need and try and anticipate what was really necessary in terms of reaching these communities who were already healthcare system and healthcare reverse already, vaccine reverse. We've got things like the Tuskegee experiments, which are fresh in some of the minds of our great aunts and great uncles and grandparents. How they, Black women and Black birth givers just die more often, as do the children they produce in labor and delivery spaces. How is all of this going to be affected by this massive pandemic? Because we knew nurses weren't going to be able to just go home. They were still going to have to show up to work, same for doctors. So how are we going to be able to make adjustments? How could we start working people, getting people to work from home? I actually had to go to bat for a group of individuals, a group of Black women, who all of white peers had just been given this carte blanche. Well, go work from home. You've already got the technology. We'll reroute your phones. And the six Black women in their department who were doing the same job, but on a slightly different code, were being told they had to come in every single day. So we immediately started to see the same old discrepancies, and the same old issues that we do as we work with marginalized communities. And so it really just became our main priority to figure out, how do we connect with these communities? How do we provide education? And then how do we continue to keep the healthcare system moving? Because trans folks in particular live, many of us live a medicalized existence. We get regular access to hormones. Some of the hormones are Schedule One. So if that's Schedule One, you can't order more than a round of it at a time per month. So how are you going to go into a pharmacy where we're already dealing with pharmacists who may not want to fulfill that prescription? It was really challenging. It was really kind of interesting for me to see how quickly I had to become an advocate, how quickly I had to become a problem solver, and then how continually we had to really, really push the folks around us to put their money where their mouth is. If you understand that Black trans and queer people, that Black and brown folks, melanated folks in general, that seniors are going to struggle to get access to this vaccine, what are we going to do to try and expedite access to the resource, and at the same time challenge that healthcare aversion in ways that are affirming? Because we can't just say, well, it's different this time. You know, we can try that all we want. Tuskegee experiments happen. Black folks who give are struggling, but like this, on this one thing, it's different. You should come trust us on this. And so it became this really interesting and really complex battle, really against misinformation, against hesitancy. Our nation make decisions like, well, if you're in an urban center, well, the political group in charge was not really supportive of a lot of urban spaces. And so we knew that in those spaces, we have a higher representation of Black and brown folks. We're going to deal with that. Watching these protests demand to open, really coinciding with hard numbers coming out, demonstrating that Black folks and Indigenous folks and Pacific Islanders in particular were all really struggling with surviving COVID. So I really just found myself kind of trying to find ways to get to as many different tables as possible, to try and remind as many people as possible, put your money where your mouth is. If we understand that there are certain communities who are overrepresented with certain negative healthcare outcomes, how can we get ahead of the curve?
I'm wondering if you could share a bit more about what, in the example you gave of the six Black women who were being told to come back to work while their white peers were allowed to stay home, what did that advocacy look like for you? What were you like? How does one change that?
Yeah. So it came down to making sure we understood who their union reps were. They didn't have the strongest union steward at the time who was looking out for them. It was figuring out who in my company could speak to them, because like different folks in admin, you know, we had reps who spoke to union folks, and figuring out who those folks were, advocating with my boss as well, and continually creating paper trails, documentation. Well, why did these folks get to go home? And why are these folks who are doing the exact same job, just a slightly different job code, not able to go home? And it really came down to tenacity, perseverance, and being a little bit of a jerk about it. I mean, I really had to lay it out flat. You are engaging in discrimination. This feels racist. This feels discriminatory based on race. Why are you letting this happen? And asking that question over and over without being afraid of conflict, because it wasn't that I was calling an individual racist. I was saying the system was doing something racist. You have these women coded in a slightly different way, so you could pay them a little bit less, I initially presumed, but it really just had to do with how they came into the department because it was merged. And so can we change that job code? Well, if we can't change the job code, how do we get them access to the resources? Because then it became, well, we don't have the right phone for them. We don't have the right laptop for them. So how do we get it? And calling IT, do you have 6 laptops? Do you have 6 phones that you can share out? And I understand that a lot of people are probably asking for these things in their departments, but we're talking about folks who were specifically doing some work around nutrition and labor delivery. So they were doing some, you know, glue that holds the pieces together kind of work related to that. And so why aren't those folks going to be prioritized? Are we not going to continue to try and prioritize the folks who need to have a baby? We're going to have to come in no matter what. When we have that racial concordance, we know that those healthcare outcomes are better. So it was really pulling every single piece of data and information I could out of pocket. It was really calling out that this is racist. What you're doing is racist. And while the system might just be functioning as you expect it to, you need to be looking at the human element, because it wasn't just an appeal to emotion. It was an appeal to logical practice. We've got people who are more likely to have to struggle with surviving COVID, and they're having to come to work every day. And we've already done this with other folks. So it was really just pointing out, not being afraid of conflict around dealing with the conversation. Well, I had someone say, well, I'm not racist and I can't really change the system. But you're allowing something that is racist to happen. That's what's happening right now. And it took a whole lot of work. Similarly, when the time came, we in the Portland area had our major healthcare systems kind of drive everyone to our convention center so that we could work with as many people as possible. And what's happening is, if you volunteered, at the end of the night, there were a couple dozen extra vaccines that were available. And as time went on and people were getting their vaccines, they would have more and more. And what we learned was that we had Black folks and Brown folks who were able to get one vaccine somewhere out in the community, but could not get it anywhere else. Or queer people who were immunocompromised, who weren't bumped up the list high enough, because while they were immunocompromised, they weren't in the right age bracket and had specifically outlined comorbidities that we said were necessary for someone to have in order to get them to jump in front of the line. And so myself and a group of other folks were asked to build this table in which we talked about, well, how can we give training? How can we give some information for folks to make sure that they can provide the best care possible to folks who may not necessarily align with their racial or cultural identities? And we ended up having to get really aggressive with, if someone from a marginalized community that we know is struggling with healthcare outcomes makes it through this space, for whatever reason, we need to get the system to bend over backwards in order to serve them, because we might not catch that person otherwise. And rather quickly, we ended up in that same situation. We had to advocate with senior leaders. We had to advocate with DEI leads and equity and inclusion leaders and tables and councils that these different health systems had. We had supervisors at the top of the chain who really needed to be pulled in. I mean, it wasn't just called in, it had to be pulled in and really made to understand some of the decisions that we were making were really, 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 really important, because someone who had already managed to get past some level of healthcare, whether it's to get their first shot or to go to this big building that was confusing and full of people with tons of noise, tons of issues, especially folks who had sensory or auditory processing concerns or disabilities related to that, would have a hard time. So how could we fast track them? And it, again, not being afraid of conflict. Y'all are doing things right now that are ultimately racist. The people that you're turning away are not the middle class white folks that Portland as a bubble is really centered around. These folks are getting access to this because they know how to navigate their healthcare system, because they already have a doctor who you know that they can push to get access to these things. They know they can just show up. These other folks aren't. And so again, demonstrating with as much data as possible to identify the harm, with the information and practices that are occurring on the ground, and then being that advocate, calling it out, challenging folks, not taking no for an answer. There was definitely a lot of, well, it's just system. It's just how things are. this job code is this way. Well, these folks have gotten access to your doctors. We can change the system. We can break it down. And ultimately, we were able to start getting some of those excess vaccines directed to folks who were just showing up from marginalized and outlier communities, because the volunteers, we were having repeats, we were having people from health systems who already had those vaccines. So how could we spread that resource out to get access to people who otherwise weren't going to get it?
Thinking about the pre-pandemic period, would you say something about your own experiences with health and healthcare infrastructure and what that's meant for you in terms of medical literacy and learning about self-advocacy?
Oh yeah, the healthcare system sucked. It still struggles in some places. So as a trans person and someone who's Black and a woman, I'm really being hit at all of these different levels. And part of the reason I got into healthcare is because I realized I needed to be a part of the system that I was trying to access. I was fortunate enough to go to a presentation being held at one of the local universities. And it was just a symposium talking about trans health and a couple of other like specific like disabilities. And the two folks who spoke on behalf of the trans community and trying to access trans care, what was wrong, what needed to happen, were so passionate. One of them was really like ready to just get into a punch fight for trans rights. And I remember just being moved by that in the moment, because they were saying in so many words, the system is built to exclude us and it doesn't want to hear from us. And so we are doing the effective equivalent of standing on the front steps, throwing bricks at the front door until somebody opens and will listen to us. Once that person listens to us, we will stick our foot in the door and hold it open until somebody starts listening to us, because we're screaming at the top of our voice. And once I got into healthcare, I wanted to do it in a place where I knew people were already struggling with health literacy, people were already struggling with access. So I went to work at a free clinic. Immediately, it was very clear that the system is not only labyrinthine and circuitous and confusing, it was set up for people to fail. And free clinics struggle with the same things that for-profit spaces do, which is there's a bottom line. And that bottom line is, how do we keep the clinic doors open? And because so many nonprofits have to follow the cycles of grants, and they get grants from taxes paid by, you know, these businesses, they have a tendency to follow some of these structures. So they build these systems to be as supportive as possible of as many people as possible. And we have to understand that from the moment of that, the moment we start thinking like that, we've decided we're going to support white middle class folks, white working class folks who are above the poverty line, even if it's not much, or right around the poverty line. But at its very, very final default, we're supporting white people, because that's the largest number of people, if we're going to help the largest number of people. And becoming very, very aware of, if you speak English as an additional language, not necessarily a first or second language, if you are actively using, if you are a sex worker, if you are trans, gender nonconforming, or queer in some way, gay, straight, lesbian, you know, under the queer umbrella, the system was built, insurance was built to tell you no. And if insurance was built to tell you no, these nonprofit systems and these free clinics that have to emulate these other systems, because that's the way that they are credited, you know, they're seen as credible. They're doing things in ways that make sense to us, because we're so used to dealing with capitalist version of these things, that the free clinic ends up having to emulate and model a bunch of that, which sucks. And so it's their job to say no. And it's no because this isn't included under Medicaid. This isn't included under Medicare. Oh, you don't have insurance. And the state of Oregon is actually really good around getting people access to state Medicaid. And so we can get people signed up and almost get the same service. And even still, with all of that, with embedded community health workers and navigators, people were still struggling to understand, well, how do I call the doctor? What day do I call them and figure this out? How do I take my meds? Because the doctor says take this twice a day, and I know they take two pills a day, and I know I'm going to forget. I'm just going to front load them. And there's medications, you can't do that. It's how do I know that going in to see a doctor, they're going to treat my abscess that I've been injecting into, and they're not going to treat me badly? How can I talk about being a sex worker who's here for a completely unrelated issue. It has nothing to do with like an assumed STI or anything along those lines. I'm having a foot problem and I'm on my feet all day. So helping these folks understand how to navigate the system was critical because they were high volume users. And the high volume users also become primary ER critical usage folks. The most expensive patient is the one who shows up at the ER for the first time, as opposed to going to see a doctor or provider. But if you're dealing with this fear, if you're dealing with this aversion, if you're already struggling with these things and the system is set up to tell you no, well, then by the time we hit the pandemic, it was wash for some people. Trying to help folks before the pandemic was somewhat easier because, well, people still believed in a lot of freedom of movement. I could call someone at a different location. There were a couple of free clinic spaces in town. Where do you usually sleep out if you're living out? You're currently houseless or housing insecure. Okay, well, what's the clinic that's going to be closest to you? If you're put on state Medicaid, you're assigned to a certain provider. Well, that isn't going to work for you. Let me show you how you can call and get yourself reassigned. Better yet, let me sit on the phone with you and help you get across the bridge. And then we're talking about trans folks who did not have any legal access or any legal guarantees when it came to healthcare. We were categorically excluded, Medicaid, Medicare, private insurance plans. And so free clinics were some of the only places some of us could access care. And that care looked like once a month they did a clinic. And so if you didn't get a call in at the right time, you'd have to wait 2 or 3 months to see a provider because only on one day did they have 10 or 11 slots to see trans folks. Or twice a month from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., they'd see a handful of trans folks. How do you even figure, well, what days? How do I get scheduled? How do you make sure you don't forget in your own schedule? What if you are having a medication issue? You need to get your prescription renewed. You're not going to see a doctor for 2 months. And all of this was in the construct of people who could access the care in some way, shape, or form. And so even pre-pandemic, healthcare in the United States was really struggling, in my opinion. They were not doing enough to challenge healthcare aversion. They were definitely not doing enough to really focus on how we support marginalized communities. And we're still not doing enough to challenge the utilization management department. That's the department that's usually making the yes or no when you put in a referral for something. They're saying no. It's their job to say no. It's their job to identify, well, this was worded incorrectly. Well, we say we cover trans healthcare. We follow WPATH, the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. Okay, you say we cover that or we follow that, but when someone is trying to access facial gender affirming surgeries or even breast augmentation for the first 2 years I was there, the answer was no. And that was really, really complicated. How do we argue from the ground up if we can't argue with the private systems or the privatized, effectively private nonprofits, large scale nonprofits that function like private institutions? What can we do to challenge the state? And so there were a lot of people. Names that come before mine in terms of challenging the state and how long they were in that fight to try and get our Secretary of State of Insurance to say, well, trans people have to be covered. Whatever you're offering for cis people has to be covered for trans people. So we had a baseline, had something underneath. Now we have to argue with the state to make sure that these particular things are now covered underneath it. Okay, we've done some of that. These systems over here are not actually following the law. So how do we get the state of insurance to that or something along those Bureau of Consumer Services, Consumer and Business Services, how do we, BCBS in Oregon, how do we get them to, you know, put some pressure on these folks? How do we get them to care? And the biggest challenge before the pandemic was how do we get people to care? How do we get them to care about our small communities? How do we get them to care about our needs in terms of health literacy when they don't even care much about health literacy of other people? Do you under this umbrella of people who are persona non grata? And if you do, you're on your own. Maybe you can find a case manager who's overworked and overburdened. Maybe you can find a CAC, which is type drug counselor, and you can get them to help you. It's always find somebody to help you as opposed to this is how you can find help or here's where you can go to find help. And so I have personally was trying to do a lot of work around supporting community health workers and traditional community health workers. We have peer mentors, we have labor delivery mentors, we have peer specialists, folks coming out of or dealing with substance use. So what were the ways that we could really implement these people and place them strategically and effectively to help counter some of the lack of care literacy that was present? My initial job at a large healthcare system was as a community health worker. That was my job title. And so my job was to talk with the I was the trans community health worker for the system. Tens and tens of thousands of people in it. We actually had hundreds of thousands of patients and tens of thousands of employees. So it was my job to play go-between. Well, if this trans person is struggling with accessing healthcare or figuring out, you know, what surgeries or how do they get hormones, how do they get scheduled? Okay, that's part of my job. Literally calling a surgeon. Do you know anything about trans folks? You're doing X surgery. It has nothing to do with their trans identity, but this person uses they, them pronouns and is non-binary. Have you worked with someone like that before? What are your protocols? Are you talking to pre-op? Are you talking to peri-op? What is happening in that situation? And so trying to find the ways that the community health workers could bridge that gap was critical. And then we also had to, well, are you struggling to find employment? Are you struggling to find food? You don't have vision covered. Okay, where can we find access to glasses? You don't have dental covered. Okay, where can we find you access to basic dental services? So just all of the food and housing. And if the trans community specifically, it wasn't as simple as, well, let me send you over to this faith-based institution, whether it's a church or center or what have you. I can't do that because they may not be supportive of trans and queer people. You need a job and you're struggling getting employment. You need somewhere to live. You're struggling accessing housing because whenever you show up, this apartment that was available for you that you're trying to show up and fill out the final paperwork for, well, there's an ID issue because your presentation doesn't match your ID anymore. And now that apartment is no longer available. And so even before the pandemic, trying to manage the social determinants of health was super duper challenging. It was not something that really any healthcare organization aside from organizations specifically devoted to that work and some community-based free clinics were trying to do because they knew that trying to get ahead of these challenges was what kept people out of the emergency room, the most expensive option, the most critical, the most dire, acute. And so I got to see what it was like for the average patient to have to work it out. Patients who would come to me with high levels of health literacy who still didn't understand how to get to the right doctor. How do I find a doctor that can work with my oncology, cancer-related stuff, and my trans stuff? How can I, as a trans man, as a mask-identified trans person who wants to get pregnant, how can I talk to the labor and delivery about respecting the identity of myself and my child? Because do you have another option of pink or blue wristbands on my kid? So all of these challenges were present. And they were compounded by just being not a middle-class, straight, white, cis person, because that's who all of our healthcare is geared for, it's who most of the studies are geared around. It's who most of the pharmacology standards are based around. And so all of these other folks were struggling beforehand. And then the pandemic came in and hit like a train truck, and people did lose access to care. Some of it was by choice. They chose not to access because, well, I want to sit back. People are going there. That's where they're supposed to go. And I don't want to clog up resources. Our community already struggles with submitting complaints. So before the pandemic, if you had a problem, well, if I submit a complaint and I am framed, or they put non-compliant in my chart, that changes the way doctors are going to treat me. I don't want to lose access to healthcare because I was working with trans folks of a variety of different ages, particularly the older ones who have been kicked out of healthcare for just saying, well, I'm trans, I'm trying to access something maybe related to that, maybe not related to that. I think I'm having an appendix issue. I think I have a severe cold, and the trans broken arm syndrome would come up. Oh, you're trans? Well, XYZ questions that don't have anything to do with this visit. By the way, we're not going to push hormones anyway. You can leave now. Struggling with folks who have disabilities, wondering, you know, which appointment is it going to be where I lose my medical autonomy? Because I already have to walk this fine line between high needs in terms of healthcare access and the challenge of people thinking I can't do it for myself. And the trans community struggles with that as well, with the requirement for these mental health letters from multiple providers, having to pour all of your pain and your history And being able to do it in a way that says I am dysphoric enough that I need access to surgery and medical interventions, but that I am not, or that, but I am still able to make sound medical decisions for myself. So it was already a mess. It was already this weird labyrinthine thing that everyone had to try and navigate. And the pandemic didn't really help with that. There were folks who were inclined to use telehealth options, phone calls, video visits. They were fine, but the trans folks trying to access surgery panicked because their surgeries got pushed back. And in some cases, folks had already been waiting for 2 or 3 years. Even before the pandemic, folks were waiting 2 and 3 years to access certain surgeries. And so while we were hoping providers would appear, it's very specific work. And so those things, even post-pandemic, have not necessarily been resolved. If you want to access facial hair removal, some health insurance companies will cover it, some won't. If electrolysis doesn't work for your skin type because maybe you have melanin and your hair is curled, and most providers have never worked with someone like that. Or the electrical current literally damages and it's scarring your skin. Well, laser isn't covered. If it is, there's one provider who covers it and you have to wait months to get in. Similarly, if you want a nurse to prescribe you to give you a shot of lidocaine so that you can tolerate the pain, because otherwise it's a topical you can pay for out of pocket. You know, all of these things were constants and continual struggles for those even before the pandemic. And so trying to kind of qualify, were things better or were things worse? It was really just a matter of things being different. Things were getting better because of the advocacy of folks who were placed to do this work and were really fighting hard as warriors on the front line to try and make change. And then getting to the pandemic was just different. It was just a different type of complicated thing to have to maneuver, because now folks they're still trying to figure out how to access housing. They're still trying to figure out how to access employment, but they're trying to do that with a pandemic in the background. So it wasn't necessarily easier or harder. It was just different. It was challenging beforehand, and it was challenging through, and still challenging now. And that's hard too. People feeling that we're post-pandemic in October of 2022, when a lot of people in my community are immunocompromised. A lot of folks in my community cannot afford to get sick because they have surgeries coming up. They cannot afford to have COVID knock a surgery that they've waited for 2 years out. And so they struggle with socialization and feeling isolated, because folks who otherwise would try and go out can't now, because now they might get sick at a critical time. And they're watching all of these folks around us who 2 years ago were like, stay inside, take care of yourself, we're all in this together. Or like, I'm tired, I have a vaccine, I've got some boosters, I want to go back out and have my life again. So now they're out in all of these different spaces, unmasked, tight-knit quarters, unmasked for extended periods of time with a variety of people. And so these same communities who are already isolated, folks with immunocompromised folks with disabilities, folks in the trans and queer community who couldn't afford to get sick, they're still struggling with isolation.
If there was a period in your life where you had healthcare aversion, what did that journey look like getting you to medical advocacy?
So I feel like my medical aversion started in my teens. I had to have my tonsils out in my late teens, and I was older, and so that was a terrible experience. The first thing that my doctor prescribed for me was not strong enough, would not believe me, would not believe my Black mother. But when my white stepfather called the doctor and got us an appointment and took me in and advocated, I had something stronger by the end of the day. So the way I was raised, I was taught to see moments in which race might be a factor, because while my stepdad was white, my mother was Black, both of her children, my sister and I, were dark skinned. And so we knew we were going to be treated differently in a very white portion of America on the East Coast, a place that had gotten rid of restrictive covenants not long enough ago. Neighbors didn't really like us. The Elks Lodge wasn't really interested. Like, they had come to our house and tried to convince my parents to leave. So trying to wrap my head around what healthcare meant was complicated. And then by the time I was old enough to have access to some of my own healthcare, I was poor. And so I was living under the poverty line. I was trying to struggle with Medicaid, Medicare. I mostly just didn't have insurance. And so I dealt with the healthcare issue in my foot. And it's a common issue. There's pretty common stuff to put. Pain management is one of the things that have to happen as a result of it. And the sports medicine doctor that I went to wouldn't help me. My foot was in really bad shape, and he's like, take ibuprofen and don't walk on it. And I kept asking, like, I looked online, I know other people with this issue, pain management is a consistent thing. It's like, is this because I don't have insurance? You don't think I can pay for the meds? And he had a million excuses under the sun. But by this point, I'd moved to a rural place in the South, and it wasn't okay. Beyond that, I've struggled with knee issues, tall human being. And so moving to the Pacific Northwest and Portland, I bounced around healthcare systems from job to job to job and never had good experiences. It was always being dismissed, being overlooked. I dealt with a significant issue on the side of my knee and general knee issues, and pain management was an option. It wasn't like I was asking them for narcotics. I don't really want that. Instead, I was trying to, is there PT? Is there OT? Is there like nerve stuff? Is there anything we can do? And I was consistently told no. And the worst experience was I had a doctor, my knee was swollen. It looked like there was a softball in there. And she sent me to get some x-rays, and she said, it just looks swollen. It doesn't really look like there's anything in particular that's wrong. So go home. But in order to do the assessment, she had twisted my leg and knee in all these different positions in different ways. So my knee had actually swollen up more, and I was no longer able to walk. So I was like, well, can you prescribe me something so I can get home? Because I'm on the bus. I didn't have a car. And she made me wait for 45 minutes in the lobby, only to eventually tell me no. She wasn't going to prescribe me anything. I could go across the street, go to CVS, get some ibuprofen, and make my way home. And it was at that point I lost absolutely any shred of faith, hope, or interest in healthcare. I just existed without insurance. I was poor, so it wasn't like, my jobs technically had some, but I wasn't signing in or signing up for it. Why did I want that to come off of my paycheck if I wasn't gonna be able to actually access care? And I didn't go back until I decided to move forward to transition. Someone had given me access to hormones. I was really fortunate to be around a Latina trans femme who had also struggled with access to healthcare and access to providers who would respect her and all the parts of her identity. And so she gave me hormones under the table. And so that's how I started. But, you know, obviously there wasn't a whole lot. And so I needed to get back into care. And so it was not until I'd been making my own way for several months. I did a lot of work to try and find someone in the community who could help me. And so I ended up traveling 2 hours by bus from where I lived in order to access a naturopath at one clinic who I knew had a good reputation for helping trans and queer people. And she was really helpful in the sense that she did get me moving forward. She did get me started, and I saw her for quite some time. But the moment healthcare forced me out of that situation, got a different job, I could no longer see her. That clinic was closing anyway. I tried a different portion of our healthcare system. And what I needed was a note from a doctor so I could get my birth certificate changed, because the state I was born in required it. And so I scheduled an appointment, and I said, in so many words, I'm trans. I need someone who knows how to write a letter because there's specific verbiage, and I need it. Able to change my birth certificate. And I needed to see a doctor who can do that. So the person on the phone searched their system, said, yep, this is the person. This is our specialist. This is someone who can help you. Well, the day before the appointment, I get a phone call that says the provider that I'm going to see has changed. And I panicked a little bit. Okay, well, you all know why I called. Like, you must have in the notes what I need the provider for, right? And the person that they switched it to, they were like, well, they probably know some stuff. Most of our providers know some things. So I went into this new setting afraid that I wasn't going to get my needs met. I get into the office and I start talking to this person and come to find out, well, it's this doctor who is claiming himself to be a trans specialist who's present. Well, I explain what I need. I explain why. He's confused. He is he is deeply confused because I know what state, I know what needs to be in the letter. I have all of my ducks in a row. So he's just surprised to see all of this. Well, he then decides before he writes this letter, I have to basically tell him my story. Like he's a therapist. I have to prove to him that I'm trans and have, you know, a consistent presentation of gender incongruence and gender dysphoria. So I have to prove to this doctor, this specialist, that I'm trans enough to be worthy of this letter. Well, I start talking about my some of my history because I have to. I start talking about what other people in the community are struggling with and why this is a problem. And what was supposed to be a 20-minute appointment turned into an hour and a half with a doctor in a typical system, which we usually only get 20 to 30 minutes at most. And I basically taught this man the basics of doing trans healthcare. He was supposedly the specialist, but did not know that WPATH was the standard. He was the trans specialist, but did not know what the standards of HRT were in terms of how to get people started. So I had to give him that information on where to find it. So I educated this human, and it put me off healthcare. Like, it put me right back off of healthcare again. And it was some months after that in which I got to see those individuals talking about healthcare, trans healthcare, and making the decision to put myself on the front lines of that, to put myself between an already struggling community that is tired, that is just trying to get through their day and can't even just get on the bus, go to work, and come home without a million opportunities to be disrespected, dismissed, and potentially physically assaulted. And I needed to put myself between the problem and the people. And so that was, it was helpful to go work at the clinic that I did, because by the time I got there, they were integrating trans healthcare from just being in a once a month, every so often, intermittent clinic into regular, day-to-day. Every provider should be able to do the basics. Here's how we're going to train them to do that. And so I felt fortunate that the way for me to get over my healthcare aversion was to get into it and get gritty with it. I was doing trainings and education around trans health. I was working the back end of healthcare systems because health record systems are weird and messy and highly specific, but I needed the technical knowledge on how do you build this in such a way that I can even see trans and queer people? How do you build it in such a way to make sure the right flags come up? How do you build it in such a way that providers can figure out what to search for when they need to order for certain things so that I can talk to other health systems with a higher level of competence? So getting past my healthcare aversion came with aggressively engaging with it, intellectualizing and over-intellectualizing it, becoming a part of its system of education, becoming a part of its underbelly and its backbone, so that I could figure out how do we get a patient in first thing in the morning because we need one? How do I find someone, how do we figure out how to track cancellation so that I can call this person, get them into the appointment right away before someone else sticks them in because this trans person has been trying to get access to their meds for a month? You know, so it was really about my aversion dissipate is the right word. I was able to start dealing with it practically when I got to a place where I could feel some level of control. And that control came from understanding. It came from saturating myself in the environment. I literally got a job at a clinic. I literally put myself in the position of how do I educate? How do I do this? What is it like? What things are important? How do I work the back end? How does this healthcare system work? How does the head provider work with the doctor of the day? How does the chief of medicine cascade down? How does all of that work with billing and admin? Because it's the admin folks who need to be able to process that through billing so that we can actually get paid for some of these procedures. For things we can't, how can we just make the decision to provide the care? Because that's our job. It was really getting into the ring, getting some gloves on, and just making my way through everything one thing at a time is what helped me get through some of my healthcare aversion.
How does that inform working with other vulnerable people who have a healthcare aversion? I'm thinking again specifically in the context of COVID-19.
I feel it gave me a strong sense of reality and what was actually going to happen. Being able to predict referrals are going to slow down. This is how we need to talk with surgeons. This is how we need to start accounting for marginalized people from the disability community, from the immunocompromised community, from our seniors and elder community. How we can start breaking down this concept of BIPOC, because communities of color is a useful enough term, but it doesn't speak to the issues that particular communities are really struggling with. The Black community needs different things than the Pacific Islander community. And while they both might be dealing with environmental issues, environmental change, and food apartheid, the ways it's happening are different. And so being able to talk to providers about how we can work with, you know, patients. So if we're trying to lower our diabetes score, the A1C, because that's one of the metrics that keeps you getting money from Medicaid and Medicare, how are we able to talk with folks who are otherwise coming in to see us every so often, who don't really take phone calls, they're not going to pick up a strange number, they don't really trust healthcare, and you give them all kinds of crap because healthcare hates fat people and their body is larger. And so how do we reach out to this person? How do we work with someone who has been eating rice their whole life, eating tortillas their whole life? You're telling them to stop eating the staple food to help their A1C, and that's not effective. And so going into COVID-19, trying to anticipate how we help these marginalized communities was something I was uniquely placed for, but it didn't necessarily make it easy to have the conversation because now everyone was in survival mode. And when people get into survival mode, they start to overlook things because now it's about survival. It's about how do I keep myself from getting sick? I have to come into work every day. We're telling us we have to reuse KN95s, or reuse masks. We're having to try and get things from everywhere. We don't really know how this is functioning. We have to put people in negative pressure rooms. It's so bad. We don't have very many of those. What is the process for getting people who have it? How do we identify them? How do we keep other patients separate? All of that was just, at first it was really gross. I mean, I do applaud healthcare for trying to deal with it, but at first it was a complete mess. And nobody knew how we were going to reach marginalized communities. Nobody knew. There were those of us sitting in these communities who were trying to explain to them that we can see the writing on the wall. We know what is coming. We know that if the healthcare that we have now is not serving certain populations, we know that COVID-19 safety processes, protocols, and how we start moving in safety is going to negatively affect certain groups the most. And watching otherwise rational, empathetic, compassionate people start saying things like, well, we just can't do anything for them. I got really, really concerned because there was a story that I know about of a patient in Katrina back in Louisiana. And he was fat, he was Black, he was old, he was disabled. And so when the water level in the hospital was rising and they were trying to decide which patients to take, they had to decide not to take him in favor of other patients. So they just left that man there and others. And so knowing that at the end of the day, healthcare will make the decision of who lives and who dies. This fear that people have of, well, if we socialize medicine in the United States or move to a more collective system, we'll have death panels to decide when people live or die. That already exists. it already exists. It's actuarial tables that are reviewed by utilization management, budgeters, and healthcare systems. Seeing in these same healthcare systems that there was, what is the cost of the vaccine going to be? How do we prioritize people getting it? And not taking into account, okay, well, what about people who lack transportation? What about people with existing healthcare aversion? Can we walk into this trying to beat and get past healthcare aversion? Like, we walk in with good language, with good modeling, with good communication, good scripting. None of that was happening. While those of us who primarily worked with marginalized communities knew that eventually these administrators and people at the top were just going to make the decision of who lives and who dies, who has enough comorbidities that they're not worth saving, which is something that happened in Sweden and the Netherlands, where people who were not a fan of lockdowns were trying to say, well, these places aren't doing it. These places are doing fine. They weren't. They were literally letting their seniors, their elders pass away, which is unconscionable in some of our communities. the lack of empathy that I knew was going to be endemic was really, really challenging. And so having to walk into spaces telling people that they're not going to advocate for you. How do you advocate for yourself when you barely believe the system is trying to help you? How do you not seem more white adjacent than community focused in those spaces? Because, well, if you're trying to convince me to do this thing, the only people trying to convince me to do this thing are white people. So what's your deal? And COVID-19 creating an even wider gap between healthcare outcomes and life expectancy for certain marginalized people. Seeing numbers getting as low as like 1,000, 1 in 900, 1 in 700, some of these communities are dying from COVID. And we're still having a hard time getting folks to believe. And instead of wanting to do the work, healthcare systems wanted to have people like me just stand in front and automatically credential them. Like, this time it isn't true. This time we aren't trying to kill you. We are in labor delivery. We are when it comes to cancer outcomes. We are when it comes to diabetes and other, it's when we're trying to talk about body size, like we're killing you otherwise, but in this space, this time, we don't mean it. But we're not going to do anything to outreach to your communities aside from maybe going to a barbershop and hand out leaflets about how you shouldn't be scared. There was definitely a lot of cynicism, but cynicism was not enough to make any of us stop. Like, none of us got into this because we were so cynical, we weren't gonna do anything. It was just seeing the writing on the wall and that being the thing that motivated us. I understand that there's a wall in front of me and all you are giving me is a soup spoon to try and to get to the other side. Well, I'm gonna use that spoon for what it's worth and I'm gonna find a way through. And if I can get enough people with enough spoons, we'll get a dent in this thing. And so that's really where it became critical for some of us to start getting ourselves on these COVID-19 panels and into some of these spaces, these coalitions, these DEI committees. The state of Oregon made a decision around how they collect certain demographic information. And they were trying to figure out how to make it standard across the board for everyone, because we weren't collecting certain information related to race, ethnicity, disability, and gender identity, sexual orientation. And so they made it a requirement. And so then it became our job to make sure our systems were following suit. So we did need some top-down approach. We needed positions of authority to say, you have to collect all this demographic information because that would start. While we know that these communities are being hurt, we have to be able to track the information. COVID-19 is a way to start with that. Well, what readily became an issue was that they weren't reporting publicly. The state was saying, collect the information. These healthcare systems were not reporting that information publicly because they were scared to. They were afraid of the numbers that were coming out because they all knew that they were all failing our marginalized and minority communities. They were reporting in some ways to general numbers, you know, certain things that they weren't trying to be completely transparent, which was so disappointing. I regularly asked, well, are we going to put out a statement specifically to speak to the trans community? Because I was still connected to that community, saying, you're not going to lose healthcare. This is what we expect in terms of how things are going to change. This is what we recommend moving to telehealth. This is what we think is going to happen to surgery. This is what's being moved back. This is what's not. And here's why. That didn't happen. It wasn't happening anywhere. And knowing that it was going to take time for them to fix their language around it. Kind of like another zeitgeist thing right now is monkeypox going across the world, and how instead of talking about it as continually about extended contact and that being the main thing and everyone needing to be mindful of it, it's something that's happening between homosexual men. And instead of just doing the work of making sure that community is getting access to resources, we have to talk about how it's happening to them. It's not an issue for everybody. It's mostly just this community. And again, we learn nothing from COVID. Instead of saying this is something that is affecting everybody, rather quickly became this is something that's primarily killing Black, Indigenous, Pacific Islander communities. Hispanic and Latin communities. So, okay, well, now we'll talk about it 6, 8, 9 months in. And it's mostly just the sadness of it. Oh, it's sad that these communities are healthcare averse. And so it put a lot of white people in the position of, why are these Black people afraid of this? Who would want to kill them? Why would this be a negative? So no information or education around why the healthcare aversion existed was going around either. So even trying to start kitchen table conversations between friends, between coworkers, was not something that was happening in terms of COVID education. So to some of us, it felt like the ball was completely dropped. These people were stuck in survival mode. They were making decisions about who was going to live. They were trying to help the largest number of people fastest, which is by default in this country, something that is white supremacist in nature. It puts white people as the default in front because they are going to be the most helped. They are going to have the most access. And so how there was a lot of say, not a lot of do. And community specific, culturally specific organizations really tried to come together, really tried to build tables, really tried to get on these committees and these coalitions to push people. If someone from a marginalized community comes in and says they need access to this vaccine, give it to them. Don't argue. Get them in the system. What if they're in another system we can't find? Don't care. Double book them. Put them in the system twice. It doesn't matter. Just get them the shots. That was really, really systematically changing for some people because we're able to understand that we need to, in order to get equity, we have to think about specific asymmetries that got us here and the specific asymmetries that are going to balance that back out little by little. I know Black folks now who are never going to get the vaccine. They don't trust it. Not only do they not trust the vaccine, the whole debacle and how things went, they're no longer getting flu shots because they don't trust anything anymore. And the only healthcare education that was really coming out around why the healthcare aversion exists was in these marginalized communities, justifying the healthcare aversion, justifying the desire to not want to engage with any of these resources or these opportunities for health. They weren't going to the people who needed it most, the people who have no idea why this would happen, those who dismiss these marginalized communities or diminish their experiences, as this was so long ago, when there are women now, indigenous women and Hispanic and Latin women who were sterilized without their knowledge and against their will. So trying to watch the freight train of COVID-19 coming, seeing all these existing problems and knowing that those gaps were only going to get wider was really, really hard. And so a lot of smaller culturally specific orgs, individuals who had compounded deeply intersectional identities and practice around how to move with that, how to make change, how to speak to these systems, really had to step up and like elbow our way into some of these spaces to make sure that it was really about harm reduction and damage mitigation. Harm reduction isn't even the right word. That's become a buzzword. It was about damage mitigation more than anything, because the powers that be in the systems that existed were not going to do the work up front. And they were just going to do the same things they always did while hoping for the best.
Do you remember when you first heard about COVID-19?
I do. So a friend of mine on the East Coast had a partner who was doing work in epidemiology. And he was telling me that his wife was freaking out about something that they just kept saying, papa, 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 papa. And they weren't exactly sure what it was, but it was pretty noteworthy. It was respiratory influenced or respiratory based, and they weren't sure how bad it was going to be, but like preliminary numbers were looking rough. And so in healthcare systems, we heard a little bit about this epidemic thing. We needed to be mindful. We weren't sure what was going to happen. So I heard about it in the fall of 2019. And 2020, I mean, I guess by the time we were rounding holidays, it was becoming more spoken about in healthcare systems. And by the time we were getting into like January, February, and it was rough, numbers were rising. we were all very, very aware of it. And what we didn't know was whether or not, you know, what that means for these corporate environments. Were we going to stay in office? Were we going to go home? And like I said, there were people checking their work phones all day at this conference about when we were going to get the go ahead to leave and go home because of this pandemic and this thing sweeping across the globe. And hearing about it, it made me nervous because, you know, we always worry that the most marginalized will be the most affected. It's just facts. And wondering, what were we going to do about it as a nation? What were we going to do about it as part of the healthcare system? And what were we going to do about it as individuals? Fortunately for me, the folks I was around took it seriously. I definitely remember that time where we were wiping down our groceries with bleach wipes. So, and before things really kicked off, my living situation at the time was with a couple of other people, and one of them had a persistent cold. What he thought was persistent cold. He was immunocompromised, and so it was something that was pretty common for him. But he said that it was different. This one just made him more tired. It was worse for him than he realized. And what he thought was a persistent cold and was causing a sort of consistent problem with his immune system, we think in retrospect might have been COVID before we were testing for it or had access to easy home tests or what have you. And so I think I was kind of mildly exposed to it. I have not had COVID that I know of. I have been testing. I'm still wearing masks. In fact, I traveled today to family stuff, and I was double masked in the airport from the moment I walked into the airport to the moment I walked out. I don't eat or consume anything during that. Not on a plane or anything because, you know, we need to take that seriously. And kind of from the beginning, seeing how my immunosuppressed and immunocompromised friends had to take it seriously, and then seeing how the people around me, because some of them are immunocompromised or have existing respiratory issues, which COVID would be super terrible. And so I initially heard about it as this kind of random thing a friend was telling me about. I was kind of, I think, maybe exposed to it at one point. And a low level asymptomatic kind of, well, mostly because if I had it, I was completely asymptomatic, as was the other person living in the house. And then it was nothing but COVID from the moment they sent us home. Because, well, how long is this going to last? Is this going to be a week? Is this going to be 2 weeks? Is this going to be 3 weeks? Is this something that is, how many people are going to be affected by this? Because you have one contingent saying it's no worse than a cold and I'm not going to worry about it. And then the healthcare system watching its emergency rooms and its ICU and its hospital beds, like literally like it was a fire sale and everyone blew them up. So I know that I got a little bit of an opportunity to hear about it early, but not, I would say, in a coherent, super cogent kind of way, because what was I going to do about it, you know? It wasn't being called COVID-19 at that time. It was, I don't remember what it was being referred to as at first, but it was something was big and it was coming. If we knew what was good for us, we would protect ourselves and we would have some masks ready to go. We would have hand sanitizer ready to go. We would be prepared to kind of eat in some if we needed to, because, you know, this thing is going to come through and it's going to be kind of rough.
What was it like living with other people at the beginning of the pandemic?
Oh my gosh. So it was hard. I was living in a house with two other people, partner relationship that they had. I had just moved out of another place and across town, so I was close to work. And it honestly sucked at first because one of the folks in the house kept going into work and they didn't have to. The rest of their employees and staff had been told that you could work from home and their job was something to do from home. And they kept going to work because for them, that was, they needed space away from home, away from their partner. They needed separate individual time. They were more productive when they went into the office and there was a low number of people there, so they felt safer. But for me, I couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle it. And so after like a week or so of that, I had a nesting partner. Well, someone who was not a nesting partner, I had not actually intended to become a nesting partner to this person. Well, hey, you want to come stay with me on a small little farm outside of town? They were living in a tiny house on a property owned by some other queer folks. And, you know, I was like, sure, we're going to be together for 2 to 3 weeks. We either choose to be together for 2 to 3 weeks, or we could be apart for 2 to 3 weeks and not see each other. And, you know, we made a decision, why don't we just like stick it out? Because, you know, it'll only be a couple of weeks. We can try that. It's like a super long weekend away. You know, it's kind of like a staycation, but we're actually working. And I am a very tall human. I'm over 60 tall. And I moved into a tiny house with another person. It was kind of wild. It was good in the sense that the only people on the property at the time were me, my partner, and the farm owners. There was another roommate who was not really there very often. And so for the first 2 to 3 months of the pandemic, I was low to no exposure except for the people on the farm. And when we went out, we were definitely masked. We went shopping with gloves on, my frog gloves, came in the house. And it was complicated because a lot of their friends were on the fence about how seriously to take it. They had friends with a variety of different opinions on the subject. Most of my friends in my social circle had a specific, you know, we're just going to talk to one another remotely, try and wait for this to blow over. But we had folks who were like, we don't believe this is a real thing. You should still come over to see us. And so after the 3 months or so, when people were trying to get them to open up, it was complicated because we could see who in our friend groups and who in our social groups were going to take the precautions necessary to protect us and who wasn't. And who was doing it from a place of, you know, screw the system, and who was doing it from a place of understandable healthcare aversion, and who was doing it and why? Well, I learned a lot more people in some of my circles were immunocompromised more than I knew. They just didn't talk about it. Watching some of my friends who were living alone, isolated, and they didn't see anybody for over a year. They saw not a single human soul in person for over a year, and doing my best to try and talk remotely. A lot of folks that people hadn't heard from in years reached out. People that I hadn't talked to in like a decade, almost a decade, and longer had reached. How are you doing? What's going on in your life? Are things cool in the world? Have you gotten COVID? and so living with people and seeing how they moved through the pandemic, because some of those folks over time are, you know, they'll wear masks in the grocery store, but they weren't necessarily doing it with some of their friends. And those friends weren't necessarily doing it with friends and friends. And so pod mapping, you build a pod, and realizing how close that was to circles of non-monogamy, where people are sexually active with one another. How do you talk about it? How do you build closed or open, you know, kind of pods, and what does that look like, and how do you protect one another from illness and viruses? And so being around folks who had some of the knowledge and skill, being around folks who didn't have any of that knowledge and skill, and how frustrating it was to see some people closer to us not take it seriously, how disappointing it was. I know that 2 years in, I'm still doing a double mask thing. I am never going to go into a grocery store without a mask again. I haven't had a flu or a cold in a long time. Why on earth would I want those things back? And seeing how other people in our social circles, through their social media, well, I got a vaccine, so I'm okay. And so they're going to big indoor gatherings, concerts, big indoor gatherings, weddings, big indoor gatherings, just general social events, dance parties. And they're unmasked for hours in a smallish room with dozens to 100 plus people. It's psychologically challenging to see that. I will never forget the healthcare workers that I was around and listening to them just be burnt out, completely burnt out through from the beginning of the pandemic when we knew how bad this was and we knew we needed to mask and keep socially distant from each other. People just weren't. And so the numbers kept rising and rising, rising. The obstinate people who were never gonna. And how those folks don't even realize that they're going to continue taking up hospital beds, not just now, but through the future, because we still don't know what long COVID does to people. There's kidney failure. Trying to talk to people about that. The death panels that I mentioned earlier, the Supreme Court in this country recently said it is legal for a health insurance company to decide how many sessions of dialysis someone in an end-stage renal failure gets to have before the insurance can cut them off. Kidney issues are a problem with long COVID. Respiratory issues are a problem with long COVID. So if you're having a kidney issue, you can't breathe, you're going to take up more space in the hospital beds. And people who are convinced that, well, I've had a vaccine, that means it is like a cold for me now, I'm not going to end up in the hospital. It's like, okay, but that doesn't mean you won't have other complications. And so seeing people who 2 years ago, that some of them I was close to, some of them were really close friends, some of them more acquaintances and things along those lines, mimic some of the rhetoric we heard at the beginning of people who were non-believers. It was really challenging. And seeing how people that I live with have, how they've moved over time. What places are they less comfortable and still wear masks? And what places are they more comfortable? And how we, as a collective and a household, have to have that discussion. And then seeing how people both honor and fudge that, and how we have to build trust with one another to feel safe enough to make those decisions. I did a little bit of traveling to see family. I'm going to go home and quarantine for a week. I have people who have done that. They've gotten off the planes and gone right back to work. They've gotten off the planes and gone right back to large collective living situations or gone to concerts and things along those lines. They haven't taken that time. And so living with people in an up-close view of hopefully folks who are similar to you, folks by and large are kind of similar to us, but not completely. And so you have to learn how to compromise. You learn how to keep distance. These moments in which, well, I'd like to try this drink that you have because it's tasty. You made a fun cocktail or a fun mocktail or something along those lines, or this thing you cooked is really tasty. Well, we can't use the same spoon from, you know, we're not going to put the spoon in our mouth and back into a pot. And who feels that way and who doesn't? And who kind of feels that way and who is better about that now, and how we go to meetings in small spaces and sometimes we're the only ones that are masked. It's really changed some of how we talk about trust, because we have to trust one another. We have to be able to do that. And we have to continue deeper conversation around pod mapping and how we build pods of safety, of networking, of family and communication, who have at least similar enough approaches to COVID and COVID-19 and how we're going to keep ourselves safe. Because I was very worried. One of the folks I live with, multiple cancer survivor. I live with multiple folks over the age of 65, one over 70. That was the target demographic for people who would struggle. And, you know, people who are also smokers. And, you know, so how are we going to protect them? And how seriously it felt to me and to protect them, to find a way to protect these folks and make sure that I was taking this seriously. Because having those people around me, and to this day, I work with immunocompromised people. I still do community health work. I'm very active in the community. And so how I can make sure that my housemates and farm mates and how we are doing what's necessary, because in one of the places I live on the farm, we're all kind of on the same page. Folks who live in the city, the place that I'm at, they're not. If they think they've been exposed, they'll quarantine, they'll put a mask on in the common spaces for a couple days, but maybe not. And so I can't go into that space. My partner can't go into that space for some days, even though we have a room there. Seeing how some people have had to do things differently. If you're in an urban environment, you get stuck in an apartment, your access to outdoor resources, your access to outdoor socialization is different. Living in a part of the world where it's cold, if you don't have those outdoor heaters, it's cold and rainy in the Pacific Northwest. How are you supposed to be outside in January where it's cold and it's raining on you? There are ways, of course, but they're challenging. And in that first year, not every patio was set up with heaters. They actually sold out, if I remember, people trying to make sure they could have some kind of option. And so living with people was good and that it helped me keep a wider perspective and what felt good around collective engagement. We're on the same page, learning compromise that people feel differently as time has gone on. And then keeping the perspective of some people have just had to move differently. Some people have access to different social resources. And if they take advantage of those resources, their risks are inherently higher. And how they've made their peace with that because of the number of shots that they've had. How they've made their peace with that because sometimes they mask. How they made their peace with that because sometimes they'll hang out in their room for a couple of days to take a COVID test or two to see if they are actually exposed and what that means. And how if they've been exposed to COVID and then they get it, they're not as bothered. Oh, I got COVID. For some people, I got it again. And how scary that feels to me to have to have COVID. I've got all my shots and I do all the safety things. Because the part of the fear of living with people is bringing it home, not wanting to be that ground zero, that initial vector, because it happened so quickly. Had family members managed to avoid it. They had small children who could not quite get the shots yet. And they got it from their mom, who got it from somebody at church. And, you know, they had done everything they're supposed to. They're staying inside. They're trying to keep the kids healthy and trying to keep the kids safe because the kids were very, very young. So couldn't get the vaccines yet and couldn't really wear masks consistently or effectively. And just making sure that my engagement with the people that I lived with felt like it had the integrity that I was hoping for around somebody taking it seriously, around someone choosing to make this an important thing. Someone making a real thing. And so that was good for me, like I said, because I developed a bunch of different perspectives. It really helped me understand compromise and how some people have to move, while at the same time understanding where my values were and how I was going to be moving through not just this pandemic, but a fundamental change and shift in how we were going to be working with, engaging with one another forever. Because I'm one of those people who's picked up masks and hope to not take it off. I don't see myself doing that. I see myself encouraging people, if you feel sick, if you were coughing, here's a mask, bro. Because if we can get to a place as a culture where if we feel sick, we can be masked, that's really what's going to protect the most people. We think we're sick, we might be sick, might have been exposed, who knows, wear a mask, put a mask on your face. But those of us who have to protect others still wearing masks, even though we know it's some less effective, still choosing to believe that we can make a difference and the lives of people in our immediate spheres, we can make ourselves safer and keep the folks around us safer.
Can you identify sort of earlier in life where you learned to be so considerate and thoughtful of other people?
I think it comes from, it's that complicated. Because as a Black person who's initially perceived as male, you have to make yourself small and you have to make yourself approachable sometimes. Most importantly, you have to make yourself non-threatening. In addition, you know, being in a white neighborhood, how do I make myself quote unquote seem like one of the good ones so that I wasn't treated as badly off the job? And seeing how some of the people around me that I knew were quite selfish and self-centered, and being raised by someone who really helped me understand that things aren't the same for everybody. And sometimes you have to be the change you see in the world. And sometimes that's still not going to be enough. And so at the end of the day, what you have is as much integrity as you can muster, because we're not perfect. And if you can lay your head down at night and know that you've done something for somebody, whether it's with recognition or not, different people have different feelings around that. I don't think we should, you know, never getting it can be demoralizing for some people. Always getting it can go to some people's heads. But if you can lay your head down at night and know that you've done something for somebody that is meaningful, then that's really the plan. Like if this earth, if this life is an engine of self-actualization where we actually care about each other and have empathy, you have to model it as much as possible while holding your boundaries around when it's not feasible, realistic, or safe. And I think getting to understand how more often than not, other people just feel unsafe. Other people feel under threat. And then seeing during COVID, how people moved into desperate survival mode. And not everyone still has the capacity to do something for somebody else. And understanding that everyone shows up in the work in a different way. Not everyone can be on the front lines at protest. Tried that, been there. Not everyone can be the front line in a corporate space or in the ivory tower academia or staring at bureaucracies and industrial nonprofit. I've done all of that. That's how I can show up for the work, because I know that there's a person out there who needs access to this healthcare who has another day job. They just need to get through their day and they need to do their work. And maybe their work is rocket science saving people. Maybe their work is teaching children. Maybe their work is none of the above. And their job is to just try and survive today. But every one of us who survives and thrives, spitting in the eye of the people who really think that we are bad or that we are mentally ill, you know, us thriving is revolutionary. And so anything that I can do to support that stuff authentically feels good to me. It feels necessary. It feels realistic, and it feels critical. And if I know that people are going to show up for the work in different ways, not everyone can show up in the same way. And sometimes you have to be the change in the world that you need to see in the world. And that on top of that, even after you do that, it may not be enough to really help this person who has been downtrodden, beaten, overlooked, and like just shy of dismembered by these systems they're trying to engage with. What can I do to make their existence a little less terrible for today or tomorrow? Helping build programs to support trans folks is one of the ways I do that. Helping call out systems when they are being racist and sexist and homophobic and transphobic and fatphobic and ageist and not caring at all about people with disability. And if they do, it's mobility related ones, and that's like it. Being able to carry that stuff and knowing that if I'm in a space, I have this platform, who am I advocating for? You know, it can't just be me. It can't just be my identities. It can't just be self-serving. While I can only speak from my experience, that doesn't mean I can't speak in favor of other people. I don't need to speak for them. I don't need to speak on their behalf all the time, because some want to do that on their own, but I can speak in favor of these folks. I can be the thing that credentials them when they're not in a room with these people, because and keeping their perspective has had real world results. I know the things that I've built. I know the things that I've been a part of. I know the people that I've helped. They're people who are getting access to healthcare, getting gender affirming care today because of the days that I cried, the days that I argued with people, the days that I had to find yet another way to go into a space, explain people like us to people who don't understand us, explain us to people who don't respect us. So doing the work, while it is beneficial, it is a little self-serving, because you know, my access is healthcare too. I need to know that if I'm going into a doctor's office, that I have a leg to stand on, and that I'm not the first, even if I'm the first patient, I'm not the first time this person is hearing about these things. And so all of this stuff blends together into the kind of person that I am, where I'm just going to get off the duff and I'm going to go do something. And being around immunocompromised people, folks with disabilities, will change the way you move. It will change your life, because you will understand the ways in which the world was built to convenience certain people. And that was done without even the remotest thought that the other people want to inconvenience. And so you got to get in there. You got to get in there and talk about it. You got to get in there and be that change, you've got to be willing to wear a mask. Okay, I live with people who are survivors of multiple cancers. My mom had cancer, so I remember her immunocompromised stuff and how we did it before. You know, being willing to bring my heart into the work, I think, is one of the things that drives me, because this work, I talk about how it isn't just hard work. You don't just bang your heart up against the wall of the system. You're banging, or your head, not just your head against what you're banging your heart. You're banging both your head and your heart. Your head because you're trying to figure out this puzzle of how to move forward, in your heart because it affects you. It affects people around you. It affects people you love. It affects people you don't know but that you care about, because this is what we're supposed to do. If we're supposed to be on this planet long enough to figure out how to care for one another and share resources, we've got to have people who are doing it. We've got to have people who believe it's possible to radically change the world and are doing it all the time, in the words of Angela Davis, like, doing it all the time. And that's hard. Eventually you learn how to gauge the involvement you can have, how to hold boundaries so that you can be in it for the long haul, so that when you've already been doing it for years and then we hit a pandemic, you don't burn out, you don't take a back seat. You already have the network, you already have the social infrastructure, you already have the professional networking infrastructure to try and make these changes happen. And then continuing to believe in myself, you know, I don't know how far I can go in this room. I don't know who I'm going to get to change their mind or who I'm going to be able to get to move differently. But if I can get at least one person to leave this room feeling like things could be different, well, then I've made enough of a change to call my involvement worth it. And so I believe in the efficacy. You know, sometimes ennui and disenfranchisement is real. People would never jump into something like that because they don't feel like it's going to make a fundamental change. I'm standing on the beach, throwing starfish into the ocean as the tide is going out. I know that. But it doesn't mean that maybe the tide will come back in someday. Maybe when it comes back, we'll have a whole different system, because reform isn't always necessary. Reform is baby steps. We can have a revolution. And if we can do that, we have to have the people who see others around them and want to speak up in favor of those people, because some of them have been disenfranchised and feel like they can't. Some of them have been systematically oppressed, so they won't be able to get to that people. Being able to use my platform responsibly is something that weighs on me often. And I'm always trying to find not necessarily new ways, because I don't have to create new ones that have already been created. It's finding other people who've done the work so I can find other ways to build different types of bridges, because that feels like I'm taking care of the people around me. And you know, so that's probably some of what drew me to social work and community health work. I do. I care about people, and I care about every last one of us getting a chance to thrive. And those of us who are minorities, those of us who are marginalized, because women are not a minority population, they make up half the world, they are potentially marginalized. Us thriving, us being free, is the revolution. It is us literally getting to have an equal place in society where we matter. It's us being hit by something like COVID-19 and it not being guaranteed that we are going to suffer most, and that we're not going to be boiled down into a convenient acronym of BIPOC, because what my community needs as a Black person is different than what the Pacific Islander community needs, even though American Samoa and Guam have some similarities in terms of what they need and how the countries treated them, and what like the big three Asian communities need, because that's different. And you know, when we get there, we will get there. I don't expect that to happen in my lifetime. But I also believe in planting trees that we will never sit under, because that is what our elders are supposed to do. They temper youth with knowledge and wisdom of what has worked before, what has been successful, and what hasn't. And the youth that we are supposed to be keeping in mind have passion, and it is their job to come into what we have created and say, this still isn't good enough. And for us to find that balance intergenerational, where we can talk to one another so that we can continue to do things for each other. So I feel like my work is around some of that, helping people figure out how we can continue to support each other. Because if we see ourselves in each other's shoes, that's one thing. But if we can see how our fight is bound up in another person's fight, and then we can see how there are people who aren't even at the table and how their fight is bound up in ours, that's how we get to a place where we're helping each other and remaining consistent in terms of believing in and supporting one another on as many axes as possible.
What does the word health mean to you?
Oh my gosh. Health is a lack of fear. Health is knowledge and literacy. Health is freedom to move, to thrive. Health is so many things inside of and outside of an exam room. Health is a lack of racism and homophobia. Health is wellness, and being well happens on so many different faces of ourselves and our society and community, and so many different axes of need, because health isn't just being in an exam room and getting a prescription. Health is understanding what gets people to that exam room, what keeps people from that exam room, so that they can have good healthcare outcomes. Health is understanding that healthcare outcomes are affected by our behaviors, by the healthcare decisions that people make, and that those decisions are actually a factor of how they communicate, and how they communicate is a factor of their implicit and explicit biases and how they communicate, the ways they communicate with people. And so all of those things come into these individual decisions. Individual decisions become systematic decisions because they become systematic behaviors. And if and health is those systems being healthy enough to understand that we don't serve certain communities. And instead, we're doing the best we can and we're going to tack them on at the end, understanding that there is no liberation for some of us. It is only all of us. It's all of us or it's none of us. And that we can't just heal part of the population, part of the world, part of the country. Health is the knowledge that I can get to an appointment because I have transportation infrastructure, that if I need to make a dietary change for whatever reason, I have access to food to be able to do that. That if I am trying to change some of the stress, that I have access to childcare and housing. I need surgery. I have access to housing to recover, because if you don't have housing, then you aren't able to get certain surgeries. They will simply tell you no. So you may have waited for 2 years and tried to find someone who in your world who cared enough about you as a trans person to support you getting surgery so you can go to their house for a week or two to at least start recovering. No, that doesn't exist. And so those people don't have health and wellness. It's people understanding, it's people being healthy enough in their own minds to understand that trans people aren't sick, we're not broken. Queer people aren't mentally unwell. We have just been able to break far enough outside of the system to see ourselves well enough to be honest. That's health. Health is not allowing the system to use its power to dictate what health is for us. That power dynamic that exists within a health system that can say you are only going to get a certain number of dialysis sessions because that's all we're willing to pay for. Your health is something that's a number. It is a financial bottom line issue for us. That trans and queer people have existed since Mesopotamia and Kingdom of Sumeria. We are in written records for longer than some of the people. Of the things, the justifications that people use against us, they call us bad. Our health is those people realizing they're sick, that they do not understand that we have always been here. And so we will always be here. And health in our society is finding ways to engage with us, to meet us in the middle where we compromise on how we can both exist, survive, and thrive. So health goes beyond physical and mental doctors and therapists. It's those social determinants of health and well-being. It's who gets access to what education and why. It's how supposedly cancel culture has run up, but now we have to cancel all the books in the library, up to and including canceling entire libraries people have defunded libraries because they had a handful of books about trans and queer people that weren't in the kids section. They were behind the counter and you had to ask them specifically. That's what I see. As health is understanding that environmental racism is killing the planet, it's killing the lands, the indigenous lands that so many different people are struggling to try and maintain after colonization. It's understanding that colonization and white supremacy and homophobia and transphobia and fatphobia and ableism are the sickness. Those are the sickness. Those are the things that are sick in our culture, not the people trying to survive them. It isn't hard to be a trans person or a queer person. It's hard to exist in a world that is transphobic and queerphobic. It's hard to exist in a world that is ableist. And so being able to see that where the actual sickness lies in our culture and in our society, I think is what is health. It's being able to see the sickness where it actually lies and changing the systems around us so that people have access to the system. Because there's this assumption that what's happening is as we move towards more progressive values and egalitarian values, what we're doing is we're trying to control outcomes, trying to control the healthcare outcomes. We're trying to control the social determinants, the outcomes of how people end up in life. That's not true. What's happening is it's on the front end. We're trying to control access to access. We're not trying to control outcomes. We're trying to control access in the first place. Who even gets to step up to the plate? Who even gets into the doctor's office? Who even gets in there and knows that they can push back against the doctor without being afraid? Who knows that you can actually appeal your denial? Who knows that once they do that and they send it to this generalized medical board, that you can supposedly fight that? You can go to state. You can go beyond that. There are ways to continue fighting. Health is knowing that you are empowered, that you have access to these things, that you can go into a room with a legislator, a senator, whoever you need to, and tell them that what they're doing and the way they're doing it right now is incorrect, and that taking the one or two ideas from the focus group and implementing the cheapest one and the fastest one and the one that gets them the best PR, that's not enough. Minimum 51%. If you're going to call a bunch of us together to talk about what your system is doing wrong and make us pour all of our pain out, health in that moment is knowing your system is sick. And you taking the bare minimum of 51% of our suggestions to make your system healthier so that we can be healthy, because we are healthy in how we know ourselves and how we know what we need. That is health. It's the other systems around us telling us that we're sick, that something is wrong with us, that we're not okay, and all of these people co-signing it. That's the part that is really unhealthy.
What does the word safety mean to you?
Oh my gosh. Safety. Safety is knowledge that at the end of the day, you have somewhere to go where you are wanted and valued, that you know you are wanted and valued. Not just that you know inside that you are wanted and valued, and that it is because the world you live in can see you as you are, not with its biases against you, not with its respectability politics on you, not with its, you know, good, you know, good kinds of stereotypes put on you. That safety can be seen. People have an understanding of you, your identity, and how you have to move through the world. That they aren't colorblind or culturally blind or blind to your disabilities, because none of that is healthy. I don't want someone to invalidate or make all of what I've had to live through, all of who I am or how I have to move through the world, disappear. Because that's unsafe. You're gonna treat me the way you treat the average person who matches your demographics and has the same average life experience, and you get to continue to impose your default as something that is normal, and it's not. It's not typical. That is unsafe for me, because that safety for you, that psychological safety for you, by default creates a lack of safety for me. part of why I don't talk about safe spaces in the work that I do. We need to build courageous spaces where we can be uncomfortable with each other. A courageous space not is inherently an unsafe one, because safe one means one group gets psychological safety. Given how things function now, that's more than likely going to be the most demographically dominant group or groups. Those identities are going to control the table. They're going to control what happens at the table. They're going to control what happens after the table. And that isn't safe for everybody. But for me to be safe, I need to know the person at the other end of the table who has a completely different life experience than me feels courageous enough to step into a lack of safety around that. That they don't know what's going to happen to them in that space. They don't have to, that challenges and not being afraid of conflict is not the same as being unsafe. Being uncomfortable is not the same as being unsafe. That's why we need a courageous space so we can find a little bit of ability to be actually uncomfortable, not conceptually or whatever, like actually uncomfortable when you hear about the racist, homophobic, sexist, misogynistic things that are happening. And I can feel safe saying that. And it's a struggle because someone like me then also needs to come into the space with enough courage to know that that person needs to self-actualize off of my pain, right? Because that's the empathy thing. Well, if they hear enough of my sad stories, and because, you know, logic is not enough, proving that the healthcare for us is what makes us happy and access society, that, you know, not being terrible to fat bodies is what actually gets the concordance necessary to get people through the healthcare system most late. You know, that isn't as important. those things aren't as important to the people across the table, but I have to have enough courage to know that this person is going to be processing that in front of me, and processing that as a result of me, my pain is going to be the thing that helps them self-actualize, and that maybe it'll work this time. That can be difficult, and so we have to learn boundaries. Part of safety in that situation is the knowledge that you're going to self-actualize with me, take these one or two ideas and use them incorrectly, implement them incorrectly to failure, and then use that as justification not to do it in the future. But I feel safe enough to say so, that I can hold a boundary, that I am not going to let someone just slide on it. I feel safe enough to speak up, but know that I'm going to be a little psychologically challenged, because how many times have marginalized people been called into focus groups for the 9th, 10th, 11th time, and they serve as cold cuts, you know, some turkey sandwiches or a cold charcuterie plate that they got from the local grocery store. It's not real food. It's happening at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Tuesday. You know, feeling that safety is the knowledge that I can go into the space, real things are going to be accomplished, and that courage is going to be exhibited on both sides until we get where we need to be. And that I have enough safety to say, no, this is the second time you've called me. Y'all didn't do anything the first time. Now we're 2 years later. You're calling the same person together, trying to address the same problem. Is it still happening? Nope. I say, no, I'm holding the boundary, and I have enough safety to do that, knowing I won't be completely cut out of the conversation because I'm done with this format, because this format isn't effective. Safety is the knowledge that I can go out on a bus or go out into any part of the country and not need a green book. Because everywhere that I have moved to, everywhere that I have lived, I have very helpful white people explain to me, don't go to this part of the state alone. And there are other parts of the state you just shouldn't go. Why? Because they're very just there. You're walking around at night alone. You may not survive. And this was stuff I was hearing literally up through today. I was told which parts of the state that I'm in I should not go to. I'm routinely told this when I visit places, which parts of the city I shouldn't go to. And it's wild to see how white folks will say this about certain black parts of town and how everybody else says this about chunks of the state. There are maybe certain cities or certain parts of certain cities white people can't go to, but there are entire portions of states black and folks and queer folks should not be going to. So safety is an awareness that things around us are unsafe, how they are unsafe, and people being able to see that they are responsible for helping build that safety. Our culture, our government, our neighbors have built safety for people with different demographic identities. They see themselves, they see their stories, they see their power reflected, they see it being effective. They've got to help everyone else see that same safety so that they can be empowered enough to move forward with that same safety so that they can thrive.
What does it feel like to hear someone tell you that there's a place you can't go to?
Normal, typical, likely, constant, upsetting, frustrating, deep disappointing, real. That's, there are parts of this country that I have no business going to alone, especially not as a trans person, a Black person, as a femme, as a advocate, an outspoken, visible advocate. Realizing that even a green book may not be helpful for some of those parts, but realizing that it's 2022, we could benefit from one, to be completely honest. And knowing that that isn't the case for white folks, you might go to a random place that you don't, people there don't know you, they don't know anything about you, you are an outsider, you aren't an outsider the way somebody like me is going to be an outsider. My mere existence is a threat to the bubble that some of these people have crafted for themselves. And they will engage in violence, social violence of erasure, legislation, social violence, or political violence of legislation and erasure, social erasure from all kinds of activities and public spaces, and literal physical erasure. They will attack me. They would be so angry that I'm alive and visible that they would feel a need to take away my life. And it's frustrating because sometimes you say that and people will say, oh, that's not true. We had a Black president. What? Racism is so dumb. I really want to bring these helpful white folks to these others and talk about why you're telling me I can't go to the rural part of the state. Tell them in so many words why I can't go there. Explain to them that when I'm walking in certain neighborhoods in the towns in which I've lived, I'm going to get the cops called on me, which is not safe because they might see a random white person walk through the neighborhood and be a little bit nervous, but they're going to wait for that person to do something shady. They're not going to wait for that for me. Being told that there are places I can't go is normal. There are places around the globe that I cannot go. I don't talk about it very often, but I would really like to visit some of the amazing bathhouses around the world. They seem so cool. Some of them are old and pretty, and there's a unique vibe in those spaces. You get to build community, and you know, you get to get clean. I love a shower. And I'm not going to be able to go to some of those places because it's not safe. I'm not going to go to those places because legally I'm not allowed. And when you bring up the legal thing and people say, well, that's just what the people chose. So majority rules, might makes right. As long as most people hate a certain group, don't understand a certain group, and want to limit the movement of a certain group, it's okay. Obviously, they don't like it when you turn that back on them and any of their demographic identities, social identities, but you know, they want to say, well, you need to give people time. It sucks because being told I can't go somewhere, that I need to give people time to get over it, means I'm not only am I not safe, there are people who are in those spaces who are just being left to die. They're being left to flounder. They're being left to struggle. They are being left behind. And it is because they don't share a certain set of demographics with other people around them. And those people feel it's justified. And those people are so afraid. They are so deeply afraid of being minorities without being able to talk about why they're afraid of being a minority, because they see how they treat other people. They are afraid of being a minority in this country or whatever country, because once they are a minority, all they are able to really see is the behavior that they have put on minorities, and they cannot conceive of a world in which those atrocities are not pushed back onto them. And so it's realizing again, that's sick, that is unhealthy. And they feel that because enough people have said so, it's okay. And that if it's enforced by law enforcement, well, those people were just doing their jobs. and how every 30 or 40 years or so, we look back and we go a little bit more, ugh, we shouldn't have been doing that. And how people will look back 100 years from now and say, oh, well, it's a different time. People should have been functioning differently. I hope we can let go of that. There's no reason that I should be able to get into a car and go in any state, any city, any area of America and not feel safe enough to get back in my car and go home. If I'm stuck out on the side of the road at 2 o'clock in the morning, that help that I might receive some help, or at the very least, I won't be harassed. None of that is true. As a trans person, I can't even travel across the country without the knowledge that there are states where if I'm picked up by an ambulance, that ambulance driver does not have to help me. They can say no. Another ambulance driver, ambulance or set of paramedics have to show up and come get me when minutes are crucial. If they take me to a hospital that does not support people like me, then I have to leave that hospital and then be driven to another hospital when minutes are critical. People like me have been allowed to die in the street because a paramedic won't help us, won't touch us. And that's their legal right. It has been reaffirmed over and over and over again. So being told that there are places I can go is normal. It is typical for me, and it sucks, and I don't like it, and it feels terrible, but it is a regular, consistent part of my existence. And if I stood on a soapbox and railed about it too hard, I would just be dismissed or shrugged. That's just the way things are.
What are some of your hopes for the long-term future?
My hope for long-term future is that we don't have to let things get so bad that we only do the thing that humans do, which is react instead of proactively do a thing, that we just react. My hope is that, you know, we used to be able to back and say things like, well, people are less homophobic, and by the numbers they technically are, but they're legislating against us. They have a new boogeyman, trans people are legislating against us. My hope is that 20 or 30 years from now, the generation behind mine, their children, are able to see just how ridiculous, unsafe, unhealthy, and how unnecessarily we moved. We tried to look back at the Spanish flu, and we saw that there are people who didn't want to wear masks. When they brought in seatbelts, people didn't want to wear seatbelts, still don't want to wear seatbelts. But now they are a much larger minority. And there is a majority who feel differently. And it isn't that I want majority to rule. It's I want people to be able to make decisions outside of a vacuum and outside of a bubble. And the more we do that, the more education people have, the more empathy people have, the more we don't not just care about each other, the more we move in ways that are supportive of other people, their identities, and the people around us and their needs. If I had a hope for the future, it would be that those of us who are carrying the torch and trying to set everything on fire are able to hand that torch back to the folks behind us, and they continue to set some stuff on fire. Because it's possible. We are capable of that. It's a world in which Indigenous people are not just seen in terms of the sadness of their plight, the land that has been stolen or lost, the communities that have been broken because they are still thriving. There are many that are still thriving. It would be that when we have a healthcare crisis, it isn't going to be a factor of knowing that X communities are going to struggle. And that if they are, it isn't going to be that, well, we're just going to change all of our communication so only focus community and just, you know, put everyone else at the end. Like, we're going to be in this together, and we'll continue to think about being in these situations together. If there is a future for us, it is one in which we are not afraid of revolution. Reform is baby steps until the system can tolerate a revolution. And I believe that by any means necessary includes by every means available. And so more people will be leaning on all of the different options we have, not just a legislative option where you participate every 4 years and give 25 bucks to the ACLU, you give a thumbs up, you call it good, and then you get mad at people who are much more progressive, who are giving mutual aid but don't really need to vote, because they're doing the work in another way. That folks in the mutual aid community are able to understand that some folks will vote and some folks are only ever going to vote, but that we understand how we can mutually support one another and benefit each other and build the empathy necessary to get across some of the chasms that currently exist. And I don't necessarily mean the chasm between somebody like me and somebody who thinks I'm an abomination who's walking this earth. That's a boundary I get to hold. It's not my job to convince that person to change the way they are. It's not my job to tell anybody how to think. But if there are people who are struggling and see how the system is failing them, that they are able to look at me and see how the system is failing me and are able to draw a corollary. They're able to draw a parallel. They're able to see how our struggle is bound up with one another. And we are willing to work at this together, because that's the future. The future is the understanding that we aren't an island. That this American exceptionalism, deep individualism that is spreading across the globe is not the way forward. There are definitely downsides to collectivism, in the sense of it can become very rigid. You are not allowed to have a personal identity. But I think part of what we are doing with these lives that we have around us is understanding the balance and compromise of where is our identity, where is our empowerment, and where is our empathy and desire to be in this with other people, beyond people who share immediate demographic information, beyond people who share immediate political opinions. There are political opinions that are harmful, in my opinion. No political opinion is ever gonna die, as evidenced by the fact that we still have anti-Semites and people who align with Nazis knowing the end of of that type of fascism was the death of millions of Jews. And they put African Americans in camps and kicked them out of the country. They killed queer people. They killed disabled folks. Like, they know, but there are still people who latch on to that identity and that social identity and that social movement. So some of these things won't die, but they are harmful. And if folks can understand, well, the Holocaust is often presented within the view of the Jewish community, and it should be. They suffer deeply. The Romani community can also be bound up in that struggle. Parts of the Black community, the German Black community, can be bound up in that struggle. Queer people, disabled folks. How we can build a bigger conversation, because it's not for me at this point in my life about excluding, and that isn't what I want to see happening moving forward in the future. It's about options. So people having more options, because we have more options, we have more inclusivity. We can talk about the Shoah and center the Jewish community who dealt with a lot of death, and also talk about how that struggle was indicative of what other people were dealing with and how other people were bound up in, and how the Jews being cast out of so many different places in terms of history is indicative of a lot of cultures being kicked out of different places and refugee status, and how you have to build a cultural identity beyond adversity, sometimes landless, and the strength that we can pull from some of those stories and some of those narratives. Indigenous community still having some pieces of land, but given scrubland, being lied to, how we can see how our struggle, like, there's no Black liberation without Indigenous sovereignty. There's no Indigenous sovereignty without Black liberation, because we are guests here. In many cases, most people are guests here, but Black folks aren't. We were brought here against our will. But my freedom isn't going to happen unless people can also see how white supremacy and colonialism destroyed a bunch of Indigenous stuff, but at the same time did not destroy Indigenous people. They are still here. Those peoples and communities and tribes and clans are still here. Black people are still here. We are not the narrative that has been built for us. I need more options. I need more opportunities. And more people building together is what's going to create that bigger perspective necessary to get those additional opportunities, build that bigger table, and to hold the systems around us accountable in realistic ways.
What are some of the things you do to take care of yourself?
Oh my gosh. I read comic books. I play video games. I take walks without my phone. I look at some of the good news that's happening. You know, where are we being successful? Which laws are being changed? I listened to the stories of positivity. I had someone tell me a story of positivity not that long ago. She works at a school. She was worried about being out at this school. She showed up and there were progressive pride flags everywhere. A lot of the young people in the school either identify as queer in some way or trans or non-binary. All of the students are much more comfortable holding hands and, you know, just showing empathy and contact and being comfortable with one another. Those things lift me up. I like food. Like most people, I like to try new and different places. I revel in the fact that, so yesterday morning, I was able to have, I had grits with eggs and salsa verde, and all of these things were a mix, you know, all these things come from different places. I get to do that. I get to live in a place where I get to enjoy so many different things and so many different people. I get to go out to events and see my own people. I get to see them reflected in their art. I get to see other communities and other cultures. I get to see something beyond the standard, deeply defaulted whiteness in this country so that I can see myself. And therapy. I really appreciate that more and more folks are talking about therapy. It is losing a lot of the stigma associated with it because therapy can be helpful. It is not currently accessible to everyone. There are definitely systems that are not making that easy for folks to get access to. But more folks are getting access to it. And hopefully as time goes on and health systems are continually identified as failing on that one, to do something different that they do. They find some differences. They find some opportunities to find joy. And finding joy is one of the things that brings me happiness. Where do I find joy? And sometimes it's just thinking about being joyful and, you know, wearing my blackness and my transness and my womanness and my queerness all at the same time. And choosing not to be afraid in a particular moment, knowing that the fear is justified, knowing that the fear is out there. And that taking my, you know, not keeping my head on a swivel in terms of paying attention is something I'm not going to do, but I can be joyful. I'm still here. I'm still breathing. I'm still successful. I'm still making changes. And other people are stepping into the ring as well. That's really what brings me joy and helps me take care of myself. A full face routine is also helpful. For zeitgeist reasons, there's a meme going around in which a very bad Ben, the orange rock from Fantastic Four, is just, he's making a very sad face, and the associated meme is my elbow looking at me have a full face routine. So just thinking about how I'm taking care of my body and the things that I am doing to make me literally feel good. How am I eating? What am I doing with my gut health? What am I consuming in terms of media, in terms of art, in terms of literature, and all of those things being more and more reflective of me and other people's identities. Choosing not to just read a book that's full of white people, no black or brown people at all, and trying to graft that experience onto myself when I've done plenty of that. There's plenty of art that I have consumed that doesn't have any black people at all. And that's fine, but I get to take care of myself by seeing myself, my identity, and my experience reflected in the things that I'm taking part in, the things that I'm supporting, the things that I'm consuming.
I'd like you to imagine speaking to a historian of the in the future, someone far enough away that they have no lived experience of this moment. What would you tell them cannot be forgotten about this pandemic?
We are still in a time when we punish people up to and including death for being poor, for being black, brown, for being not white. We don't want their whiteness. It's being black, brown, indigenous, being disabled, for being fat, being too old or too young. We don't get autonomy anymore. What we can't forget about the pandemic was how starkly it reminded us again that we exist in a time in which inequality is assumed to just be a thing we have to accept, when we can feed the world dozens of times over, when we still are able to identify that chocolatiers are using slave labor, child labor, that domestic slave labor is a huge deal, that there are children in the United States who are going to starve today while a billionaire goes to the moon, while law enforcement is still unable to see what is happening to themselves. Law enforcement lost the largest number of their own staff to COVID, and that not changing some of how they move with empathy. Something that I think we cannot forget is that COVID-19 really brought out a lot of resilience in people. They learned to weather something tough. But what we want to do is focus on the resistance of people. The resilience focuses on the trial, on the negative, on the oppression. It's the resistance of the people to continue to make sure we weren't an afterthought, to make sure we weren't just tacked on to the end, to make sure we weren't just let go. In all of this, that's really important, because we live in a time in which those things are okay. People said a lot of stuff, and you'll read a lot of stuff about this time, about how trans people were on the come up and we were getting access to healthcare. But if you have a little time, go back a little farther and see how Dr. Martin Luther King actually polled in terms of public support in 1968. He was one of the most hated men in America. And even now, protesting in the streets, "We agree with your mission, but not your methods." He wrote some letters from a Birmingham jail which specifically talked about folks who think that way and say those things. If you want to think about COVID-19, think about the resistance that healthcare providers put up, that marginalized people moved through. Resistance to believe that the health system could help some of us and more of us, that we could bring people across the divided bridge, that there were those of us out there who weren't going to forget us, but that it was us doing it. We had to think about us, the food for us, by us. We had to save ourselves, and that wasn't fair. If everybody is struggling, everybody should be coming up together. And that didn't happen. There was a lot of rhetoric. We were banging pots and pans outside of windows and doors, but we weren't paying nurses more. We weren't paying doctors more. We weren't paying community health workers. We were getting people to the front lines of getting access to the shop, being left behind. We weren't paying those folks more. We weren't making it easier for them to do their job. We were literally watching people quit. We were hemorrhaging staff, and they were just telling the existing people to try harder, to work harder. They were saying they hoped for change, weren't actually doing it. They were saying they wanted things to be different. They wanted to help people, but then doing the bare minimum. The fact that we were able, that many of us were able to live through this pandemic, should never be overlooked. A lot of people came together. A lot of people were able to make change. A lot of people were able to survive. We lost like 3 million people. Right now, we're still losing thousands a day. And we've become so numb to it because of the way our society works. Because we have our actuarial tables, our death panels in our mind already, and we've already made our decisions. The majority has made the decision about who can live and who can die. My hope is that if there's someone who has no lived experience of this, who, depending on how digital records work, hundreds of years in the future, we didn't learn a whole lot from the Spanish flu. We didn't learn a lot about homophobia from the 80s and 90s when we were letting people die from AIDS. We as a culture are still in a place in which we are struggling to survive. And the moment we are reminded of that, we drop people. Because that's what PACs do. They let their outliers become targets and leave them behind. hope is that people in the future have realized that everyone's struggle is bound up in each other. We could choose to make a different decision this time. We didn't. So don't give us all the benefit of the doubt. Don't just let us slide. Say we did the best we could and understand that. But let it be a yes and. Yes, we did the best we could. And there were other things we could have done differently if we chose differently. Because the people who come after us need to learn from our mistakes. They need to learn from our successes. And whatever it is they have walked into, they need to be able to say, this isn't good enough yet. We need to keep going. Because we can't let what happened in the past to hundreds and thousands and millions of people across the globe who didn't have access to resources, we can't let that happen again. We can't punish people for being poor or fat or sick or old or not from a quote unquote failed country. And I hope that term dies out, global south, all of it. I hope things are different then. And I hope people understand that having access to options and opportunities is what makes change in our world.
I want to thank you so much for the generosity of your time and for the act of speaking truth to power. Those are all of the questions I know how to ask at the moment. So I just want to open some space. If there's anything you want to share that my questions haven't made room for, please take some space and share some.
I mean, the only questions I have are questions I can't get answers to. Have they finally put hot dogs and hot dog buns in packages the same size? Have we figured out that capitalism isn't the way? Polar ice caps melt. There are people who care right now, and there are people who are trying. There have always been people who cared. And my hope is that there are more people who continue to care. So the only questions I have to leave forward is, how much do you care? What are you doing right now to make change? And whatever it is you're doing right now, what if for a split second you thought it was the bare minimum that you could be doing? That there is another bridge, another group of people, another lost, stolen right, that you can build a bridge toward to help people get over, under, around, and through. What are you doing right now to make a change? And what if you try something really, really radical tomorrow? Reached out to somebody new, someone different, someone new who's walking a similar path or parallel path, but you haven't quite crossed over. Who is that person, those people? What work can you challenge yourself to do? What additional gumption can you pull up in yourself, which is going to be really hard for people kind of like me who do a lot everywhere? What if you thought about the work you did differently and tried to build one new relationship with a marginalized group of people? What if you had a whiteboard and you wrote on it the three or four groups who you still don't think that hard about or know enough about? When I started this work, and honestly, I continue it, if I have a whiteboard near me, I write down age, disability, and body size, because those are the three I really need to keep in mind, because I am able-bodied, I'm slim, and I'm not old enough to have society overlook me or try and take my autonomy or assume I'm infirm in some way. And so I continue to, what new bridge can I build with one of these communities? What way can I think of or say something in favor of one of these communities? How can I talk about other Indigenous community with different plight that still struggling under white supremacy that I haven't talked about yet because I don't know enough? So what can I do? How can I build a liberatory consciousness? Go from awareness to analysis, get some history, get some understanding, figure out accountability. How am I going to hold myself accountable in these spaces when I make mistakes? Am I going to hold myself accountable to continue doing the work and then get involved with the action so that I can be sustainable, so that I'm not just jumping from awareness into an incorrect action that isn't helpful and unsustainable or ultimately causes harm. Yeah, because I think I ask other people about that because I ask myself, what am I doing? What am I doing today? What bridge can I build? What bridge already exists that I can get some other people to cross with me, stable with it? Because those are the things that matter. Individual actions can snowball as long as we are able to look at systems and deal with systems and the people within systems that are perpetuating the systems. Yeah, I think that's what I have. Shay.
Thank you so much.